take you now to London, England.
Good evening. I am going to talk to you tonight about the European situation, as it is affected by the events of the last few days. And the first thing I am going to say to you is stop worrying. I have not the slightest doubt that you have been reading a lot of alarmist cables from Europe. You have been told that the Second World War, which of course you have been led to believe is inevitable, is just round the corner, that Hitler is ready to march, just in what direction, of course, doesn't matter, and that Mussolini has drained the Mediterranean and captured the British fleet with his cavalry. Nothing of the sort has happened. I'm sorry that I can't be more thrilling, but there it is. Hitler's legions are still goose-stepping in Berlin, and the British fleet is still afloat with plenty of water under it in the Mediterranean. But enough of this fooling, as the British Prime Minister once said in Parliament. Let us get down to a consideration of just what has happened. Hitler has made a deal with Austria, at the point of a pistol, it is true, but without fighting. A British Foreign Secretary has resigned because he did not agree with his Prime Minister's policy. Mussolini has offered to begin immediate conversations to improve Anglo-Italian relations. And whether he is in earnest about the immediate improvement or not, time alone will tell. At any rate, he is not itching for an immediate fight. In the light of all these facts, what is there to get alarmed about? No one has hit anyone yet, and no one seems likely to start the free-for-all that the logical pessimists have been predicting for nearly 20 years. There have been more acute crises before, and there will be crises again. The truth is that no one in Europe wants to fight. Several nations and their leaders do want a readjustment of territory or power or prestige, but they have not the means to compel these changes by force, and if they had, they would prefer, like sensible men, to achieve their ends by negotiation. Now let us go back to the beginning and consider just what happened in the last week or two. First of all, Hitler had what has come to be termed a purge. He retired a number of elderly generals, some of whom were supposed to be rather lukewarm in their admiration of his regime. A few months ago, the British Secretary of State for War did the same thing, but no one talked of it as a purge. A few days later, the French made some changes in the interest of youth and the higher command of the army, but there was no suggestion of Epsom salts. Queer, isn't it, how these things change their complexion when they are done by a democratic government? And this is not a sneer at democracy. It is one of the weaknesses of an autocracy that its ruler is always liable to suspicion of personal motive. And in this case, perhaps there was justification. The older Prussian officers do not like the upstart Austrian corporal, who is now supreme ruler of Germany. And some of them probably have a hankering after the old Hohenzollern regime. In that case, wasn't it just as well to get rid of them anyhow? Personally, I am inclined to think that their age was the principal objection to them. The German army is a professional army with a high sense of duty, and I think can be relied on by any government in power. The next shock also came from Germany. For years, the independence of Austria has been one of the basic principles of what is known in Europe as Allied policy, meaning by that the policy of France and Great Britain and the satellite countries, and in the last resort, the policy of France. I say the policy of France because France's policy has ever been to block anything that might strengthen Germany. Britain had only a secondary interest in it as a friend and ally of France. At the time of the peace treaties, Austria was ready and anxious to join up with Germany. She was not allowed to do so, and as a result, she suffered all sorts of economic troubles which might have been avoided. Her independence created a vested interest for her politicians, but still a large proportion, some say at least 50%, of her population looked to eventual union with Germany as a solution of their troubles. Germany, of course, never acquiesced in the separation of the two German countries. And when Hitler thought the time was right, he moved, suddenly and dramatically, as he always does. He sent for Dr. von Schuschnigg, the Austrian Chancellor, and told him plainly that the time had come when Austria must become a vassal of Germany. He has not destroyed formal Austrian independence yet, but no one thinks it will live long even in form. Austria has joined Germany, and the Anschluss is accomplished. The forms of independence may linger on for a while, but they will deceive no one. And who cares? First, let us consider the nations. France cares a good deal, because she fears anything that makes Germany stronger. Czechoslovakia cares a great deal, because she fears her turn will come next. Britain cares not at all, except insofar as she would like to see her friend France get her way. And nobody else cares at all. Britain does not care enough to fight or even to protest. And without Britain, France can do nothing. So much for the Austrian situation as a cause of war. That is my analysis of the attitude of the nations. With peoples, it is different. I know that in all the democracies there are many, perhaps even a majority, who bitterly resent the methods by which Austrian freedom has been suppressed, who hate totalitarian methods, and hope to see them someday overthrown. But only a very few feel strongly enough to fight about it. And most of them, I suspect, are fighting now in Spain.
Next is the threat to Czechoslovakia.
That is more serious,
for the Czechs are a tough, hard-bitten lot who would as soon fight as eat. And they are probably the most liberty-loving and democratic people in Europe. But they have within their borders some 3 or 4 million Germans, concentrated in the northwest corner of the country, the districts known as the Böhmerwald and the Egerland, on the borders of Germany. It must be admitted that when the Czech state was first set up, the Czechs were not too kind to their German fellow citizens. I know, for I have seen how their language was suppressed, how they were denied public employment, and so on. All that is over long ago, but the bitter memory remains. And the German Czech citizens ardently desire union with Germany. That brings us to the next scene in the last week's drama. Last night, Hitler made his eagerly awaited speech to the Reichstag. And in it, he indicated clearly that he regarded these German Czechs as German citizens entitled to protection from the Reich. Just what form that protection will take when the time comes, he did not indicate. But I venture to predict here that even if it takes the form of annexation of the German Czech provinces, it will not lead to general war. France might fight if she had allies, but Britain won't fight for Czechoslovakia. And Russia, which is an ally of both France and Czechoslovakia, is at the moment, at any rate, in no shape to undertake a foreign war. Now we come down to the incident which has got you all excited. The resignation of Captain Anthony Eden from the high post of Foreign Secretary of Great Britain. There's no denying that this resignation has caused a flurry all over Europe and has got people in this country and America guessing about what is going to happen next. But foreign secretaries have resigned before and the skies did not fall. Only a couple of years ago, Sir Samuel Hoare resigned, and nothing happened except that he was succeeded by Eden, who initiated a new policy. A year or two before that, Sir John Simon resigned and gave way to Hoare. Hoare and Simon are now back in the government, and it is a safe prediction that Eden will soon return to some other office, and who knows that one day he may not be Prime Minister. In passing, it might be amusing to recall that a certain gentleman from Abyssinia, named Haile Selassie, who was now living in retirement in England, was responsible for the fall of both Hoare and Eden. Eden because he was too kind to him, Hoare because he was not kind enough. But joking apart, everyone sympathizes with Eden. He had to go, but he has gone nobly. He went because he refused to stultify himself by advocating in Parliament a reversal of the policy for which he has stood since he has been at the Foreign Office. And he has gained immensely in public estimation in England by the stand he took. I hope I am not being cynical when I say that he is young enough to profit by it. He is only 40 years old and has many long years of public service before him. For a week, Britain has known that something was wrong in the cabinet. There was much speculation about what it was. Now we know that Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who is a realist and a masterful man, had made up his mind that the time had come to give up attempts at ideal solutions of the European problem, such as through the League of Nations, and deal with facts as he found them. And the two outstanding facts were the two dictators, Hitler and Mussolini. Both had grievances that had to be recognized and, if possible, put right before Europe could turn over in bed and go to sleep comfortably. And Chamberlain told his cabinet that he was going to settle with them on a realist basis. Eden was tied to the League of Nations procedure. He had for a couple of years been the League's chief representative in Europe. He had denounced German and Italian aggression in Spain and elsewhere, and he had particularly offended Mussolini. Then came Count Grandi, Italian ambassador in London and one of Europe's cleverest diplomats, with a proposal that Italy and Britain should at once open negotiations for a settlement of their differences. Eden replied that he couldn't talk settlement to Grandi until Italy had given concrete evidence of her good faith while withdrawing her troops from Spain. He also objected to the recognition of Italy's conquest of Abyssinia, which, of course, Mussolini had made a sine qua non of negotiation. When Eden reported to Chamberlain what he had done, Chamberlain was shocked and angry at his missing such a chance, and next morning, when Grandi called on Eden, Chamberlain walked in and took charge. Just what he told Grandi has not been disclosed. But this morning, Grandi called at the Foreign Office and reported that he had instructions from Mussolini to begin negotiations at once and to accept the British proposals for the withdrawal of his troops from Spain. So far, no official announcement of Eden's successor has been made, but it is reported unofficially that Lord Halifax will be the next Foreign Secretary. If that is so, Chamberlains have played a bit of very clever international politics. Lord Halifax is persona grata in Germany. His recent visit to Hitler, at which he talked to him about the possibility of restoring some of Germany's colonies, is still fresh in German memories. No better man could be found to settle outstanding irritations with Germany. Chamberlain himself has established friendly relations with Mussolini, so that Britain is today in a better position to deal with the two dictators, whom some look on as possible disturbers of European peace, than she was before the change. With the going of Eden, there has been an immediate improvement in the European situation. All this is said in no disparagement of Eden, who was an honest, brave, and able man, who was given an impossible task, and who tried faithfully to carry it out. That he failed was no fault of his. It was the world's fault, and Eden will have the sympathy of everyone who would like to see good neighborliness and honest dealing take a place in international affairs of power politics. It is an old saying that who sups with the devil must have a long spoon. Well, Eden's spoon was not long enough, and he is not to blame for that. The cheers he got in the House of Commons this afternoon when he made his statement in explanation of his resignation testified to his popularity and to the sympathy of the House. But that sympathy didn't override a realist conception of the situation. Chamberlain was also cheered, and he will get his vote of confidence when the socialist censure motion is debated tomorrow. People are saying again that Britain has lost face because she backed down before the dictators. Perhaps she has done so, but I think history will decide that she was wise in recognizing facts and refusing to be stampeded into war to support outworn treaties which almost everyone today would like to see scrapped or at least amended. The country that has lost most prestige and most real power is France. She has sat on her all along for the letter of the treaties, and they have gone. And she has discovered at last that not one of her allies is willing to fight with her to maintain the treaties. I know the cry of perfide Albion will be raised again, and not only in France, but perhaps also in America. But let me commend this thought to those who are disposed to raise this cry. Is not Britain doing just what our own isolationists and the many Americans who would not call themselves isolationists would like us to do, attending to our own business and refusing to be drawn into a quarrel where no possible interest of our own can be affected? Thank you, and good night.